The Zombriad, a master and commander fanfiction story, written by The Elb and read by Lutzula. The plague spread like fire through the population of London. Jack had travelled from Ashgrove as soon as he heard the news from Half Moon Street, telling Sophie that she was to keep the servants and the children as isolated as possible. She had nodded through her tears, omnipresent since Stephen's letter had arrived. "I will. I will, of course. Oh, Jack, look after him." Stephen looked like he was in need of looking after. He was sitting beside the bed, looking paler than Diana's corpse next to him, and pitifully frail. "Brother," he said in a whisper, as though any more volume would be too great an effort for him. "Stephen, I am so..." Jack looked down at the corpse, and a sob ripped through him. She had been so warm and spirited and full of life, and they had been lovers. Stephen stood up and comfortingly touched his hand. "There, soul." "Oh, Stephen, and me blubbering like a..." He dashed tears away and pulled Stephen into an embrace, who sagged against him without a sound. Stephen's face was buried in Jack's shoulder, but he turned and looked at the white body, in a white nightdress on a white coverlet. The only difference between her face and the pillow was the black hair framing it, and Stephen wondered if the world had lost all color. Jack was the only thing in the room that could not be measured in shades of gray. Diana's coffin was in the front room, ready to be carried out. He was going to be late for the funeral, Jack had told him in a muted tone, the hushed, sympathetic voice he had grown so used to. Would he not have even a little breakfast? Stephen refused, as he had the day before, and the day before that. In any case, the breakfast table was currently being used for the dissection of a plague victim. A young man, found in the gutter, like so many of the victims, and he was 5 days from death now. Thus far, in all of his dissections, Stephen had found absolutely nothing abnormal with any of his cases. He had been called out to the living, and had found no symptoms other than inexplicable dying and the bite marks. With this body, he would examine the head again. He had already peeled back the scalp, and was now sawing through the skull. The brain was sickly, glistening green, shriveled, and throbbing. It took a lot to disgust Stephen. He prodded it in fascination, and it shuddered, as though in anger. The corpse's eyes opened, as did its mouth, a long grey tongue snaking out of it, wavering upright, as though tasting the air. The white pupil snapped towards Stephen. Stephen did not think, but acted instinctively. He grabbed his most wicked scalpel as the torso rose, the head hanging limply back, and plunged it into the pulsating brain. It gurgled, almost indignantly, and fell back. He was trembling so much he could barely stand. His legs were about to give way. "Jack," he croaked, and again, "Jack!" with more urgency than he had been able to manage since Diana had. He staggered into the front room, even as he heard Jack's footsteps thundering above. His heart had broken when Diana died, but his very soul froze as he stood in the doorway and stared. The coffin lid lay about the room in splinters, and Diana sat upright, her chin on her chest and her grey tongue writhing as he took a step forward, oblivious to the tears on his face. She stared expressionlessly at her broken husband out of blue and white eyes. "The Blue Peter," he said in wonder, remembering, and fell to the floor as his legs collapsed beneath him. Stephen watched Diana's head as it fell. He nodded as it bounced towards him. Jack was shaking as he wiped the dark, clotted blood off his sword, and as he sheathed it, he held out his hand to help Stephen up. Stephen ignored it and stared wide-eyed at the head by his knee. Jack grasped him beneath his arms and lifted him to his feet, but Stephen made every sign of collapsing again, so he half-carried and half-dragged his friend out of the room, sitting him down on the stairs. He shut the door, still trembling. "Stay there, Stephen. Just stay there. I will be back in a moment," he said, as he bounded up the stairs, suddenly gripped by the urgent knowledge that they had to get out of this house immediately, get out of London immediately. He had neatly unpacked his own valise as soon as he arrived, and was able to pack again within minutes. Stephen had been sleeping in his clothes, and his own valise lay unopened in the bedroom. Jack thought about Stephen's current state and emptied both cases, putting essential items into one. The house was silent, he realized. There were at least two servants, women, for they had prepared Diana for the funeral, but he had not seen them all day. He ran down the stairs again. Stephen looked up at him, a ghastly expression on his face, and then pointed to the wall, where he had carved the word "Bites" deep into the plaster, the B bloody from the scalpel. Jack shifted the valise to his left hand and gently took Stephen's, pulling him to his feet. He swayed, but did not fall, and Jack led him out onto the street. Chaos reigned. Men and women ran, screaming, and at the far end of the street there was a group of the shambling, stumbling, white-eyed corpses, their tongues the most animated parts of them. Until they came across a fallen woman, then the corpses immediately next to her became frenzied, ripping her apart as she screamed. A man ran back to help her, and Jack saw his head ripped from his body in a single smooth motion. The corpses abandoned the mangled, crushed woman and fought over the head. The body fell, twitching. Stephen had frozen and watched, the irises of his eyes encircled by white. Jack dropped the valise. Three men were fighting with a cabbie over who got to ride away. Jack drew his sword and calmly cut the horse free. He lifted Stephen onto its back, who continued to watch the fast-approaching mob, unresisting, and climbed up beside him as the driver and the men noticed, turning their fear and fury on him. The horse protested at the weight, but Jack urged it on. It whinnied in terror as a gurgling moan rose up from the moving bodies. Jack gripped the creature's mane with one hand and wrapped his other arm around Stephen, who patted the horse's neck in a daze. It cantered to the end of the street, and Jack looked over his shoulder. The mob had stopped outside the door to Diana's house, for it had overwhelmed enough victims to bring it to a temporary stop. They walked to save the horse until they saw any more of the walking corpses. Stephen looked a little more normal now. He was just as pale, and had yet to speak, but he did not look like one of the corpses himself. Jack still led him by the hand, for occasionally he would stop and tremble, and Jack had to gently coax him forward. They had only seen three of the bodies since they left London. Stephen had tapped his forehead, and Jack had shot them with his pistol. They had come to an inn about 14 miles outside the city boundaries. The barmistress had taken one look at Stephen and hustled him away to sit in front of the fire while her husband plied Jack with questions. Very few people had made it out of London, it seemed, so there would be no trouble in getting them on the next coach to Portsmouth. Ashgrove Cottage was quiet. Jack and Stephen approached the house, respectively hopeful and terrified, both anxious. Jack strode, and Stephen trotted to keep up. The front door was left ajar, and both broke into a sprint when they saw it. It was the smell that was the worst thing, the smell and the ringing silence. There was a trail of blood through the house. They followed it to the largest room. A bonneted head was in one corner. A headless body lay a few feet away from it, a body that could only belong to Mrs. Williams. Stephen knelt and moved the arm. It was limp. Jack did not move, but stared at the grotesque pile her feet pointed to. Stephen looked up. One of the twins lay on top of Sophie. Sophie's body and neck were unmarked, and she stared up at the ceiling, peaceful and infinitely sad, her eyes glassy and grey and surrounded by bright red blood. The top of her head was gone, and there was a deep, dark cavity. One of the twins was sprawled across her, her throat ripped out, her eyes clawed out, her limbs crushed and twisted. 2 feet away lay George's small body, like a wrung-out rag doll. Jack moaned, a long, low moan of absolute despair. He stepped towards the bodies, then away from them. Stephen heard a creak and then a shuffle, and he stared into the gloom of the next room. Jack, he said, the first word he had uttered since Jack had decapitated Diana. Jack followed Stephen's gaze and raised his pistol, his face twisted in inhuman rage. The pale figure stumbled forward out of the shadows, and its fingers flexed. Its hair was yellow at its scalp, but it was matted with bright red beneath the ears. One lock was stuck to its cheek, like a long, jagged slash. It moved and fell away as its tongue violently tasted the air. Jack lowered his pistol. It was Fanny, or Charlotte. He could not tell. How could he not tell? The last of his family. "Jack, it is not your daughter any more," Stephen croaked, slowly, every word deliberately placed, as though he was learning to speak again. "She is already dead. You must shoot her." Jack turned on Stephen with a roar of fury and pointed the pistol at his head. "You have to kill her." "How could you say that? How can you say?" Jack remembered Stephen's face when he had killed Diana. Killed her corpse. Killed that thing. He sobbed to see the terrible, terrible sympathy on Stephen's face. Stephen looked away. He looked past him to the dead girl. She was gaining determination and speed with every step. Her bloody jaw worked furiously against the air. "Shoot her, Jack." Jack lowered the pistol, raised it, lowered it again. "Oh, God! Oh, my God! Shoot her!" She was 9 feet away now. 8, 7. She slipped on the blood, but regained her balance. 6. Stephen stood up, pulled the pistol from Jack's hand, and shot Charlotte between the eyes. Her expression did not change at all. There was not the least sign of shock or pain. Her body dropped to the floor. Stephen dropped the pistol, and Jack cried out in pain impossible to express. "Come. Come." Stephen steered him out into the air and the sunlight. There were swallows flying. Jack threw up and curled up on the ground, sobbing. Stephen held him, rocking slightly, staring through the open door of the cottage. Eventually, Jack's sobs faded away, and mechanical breathing replaced them. They burned Ashgrove Cottage to the ground. Before Jack had heard about Diana's death, he had received orders to take command of the HMS Blessing, a fifth-rate currently docked in Portsmouth. They rowed south, weighed down with loaded pistols. The Blessing was still there, the only fifth-rate in the harbour. There was a feeling of wild rumour and mild panic, but no hysteria. Jack had sent Pullings, Mowat, Killick and Bondon ahead when he had gone to London, and they were not expecting to sail for over a week yet. They went to the Lieutenant's Inn, and Jack told them briefly and coldly of what had happened. Pullings nodded slowly in horror and unvoiced sympathy. The captain's expression forbade any mention of what had happened at the cottage, and the doctor sat on a chair by the table, staring at the floor with haunted, sunken eyes. They had heard rumours of London entirely overrun by invaders, plague victims, demons even. Killick had looked at the pair of them and had immediately gone to the local tailor with measurements, and Bondon was downstairs harrying the innkeeper into drawing a bath. Jack, Stephen, Pullings, and Mowat sat in Mowat's bedroom. "The safest place right now is afloat," Jack said, like a dead man. Stephen nodded silently, not mentioning the obvious danger of men living enclosed in such proximity if one of them should have a bite. "The Blessing is to be made ready as soon as possible, with enough stores set by for a long voyage." "Sir," Pullings began hesitantly, "I know you do not approve of women aboard, but my wife is at home, and I beg you to let—" "Of course we will take her, Pullings," Jack said, with an uncharacteristic snarl. Stephen flinched, and Mowat's eyes widened. "And any other woman we can fit below decks. They will be coming." No one voiced the question of whether he referred to the women or the living corpses. "We have several courses of action to consider," Stephen said in a voice a little higher than a whisper. "The war with Bonaparte continues. He will press this advantage. I think that until we hear otherwise, we must consider London lost, and everyone in it, which includes the Admiralty. The war in the peninsula will continue in what is most likely far better shape for the want of interference from London. Wellington is more than capable. But Bonaparte will seize this opportunity. Also, we must know where this plague came from, and where else has been affected." Jack's countenance was that of an impassive, godlike captain. Pullings and Mowat knew enough of the nature of the doctor's work to know when to be quiet. "We must also consider the long-term effects of this situation. These revenants can be killed by pistol shot to the head or decapitation. We do not know what else. The disease is spread by biting. They are already dead, so we cannot count on natural death ridding us of this threat. We must consider evacuation." "Jesus Christ," Mowat muttered, looking out of the window across Portsmouth. "If this plague did not come from the continent, it will certainly spread there. There are advantages and disadvantages to taking one of the Channel Islands and turning it into a temporary haven, until we can discover whether the continent is safe or not. So we need to gather intelligence, fight off the French, and rescue and evacuate as many people as we can. How do you propose we do this all with one ship, Doctor?" said Jack, a little too sharply. Stephen stared blankly at him. "I do not. There are other ships in this harbour, and yours is the grandest. Does that not make you the senior officer?" "Not necessarily, Doctor," Pullings said softly. "But we will certainly inquire as to the captain's position in the Admiralty hierarchy. Will we only speak to the naval commanders?" "No," said Jack, still looking at Stephen. "The merchantmen and the private vessels as well." "How many of them?" said Mowat, looking down to the harbour. "All of them." Revenants. Plague transmitted by biting. The patient was bitten by street urchin, described as mad. I cleaned the wound and bandaged it, but on the third day she was dead. The patient seemed entirely healthy until the third day, bitten of a Tuesday evening, died a little after midnight in the early hours of Friday morning. J.A. arrived late Sunday night and left Sophie and the children healthy. We stayed in London 4 days until the funeral, but Corpus IV had been dead for 5 days. Query: why did the revenants awake simultaneously? Was my exploration of the brain the cause of the awakening, or would four have woken in any case? Was there any stimulus for Diana, crossed over, the patient? Why did she awake 1 day earlier than four? Was the urchin dead, or can the plague be passed from one living infected to another? The patient showed no signs of anything that might be construed as madness. A sigh in the sleep, and she... The islands of Britain were no more. The islands that had once been Britain were so densely infested with revenants that all of its inhabitants had died or fled. Britain was now a fleet of ships, each one a strictly governed nation with its captain as prince, whether originally of the navy, the merchant service, or civilian. But the Lord High Admiral and unofficial emperor of the fleet was Jack Aubrey. "Peace," said Stephen, as he was carefully handed up the side, "an immediate alliance and unconditional aid." Wellington had pushed the French back to the Pyrenees, but had in turn been pushed back by the revenants, for some had been living since the earliest days of the plague, and every day a revenant was alive, it grew stronger, and, far worse, faster. The French army in the peninsula had joined forces with Wellington's army, and much of Iberia was secure, if ravaged, with the barest fraction of its farming population remaining. The combined armies were attempting to herd the revenants into the southeast. They had come primarily from the north, and the revenants had spread faster than the belief in revenants, and while Stephen understood the reasons, he still found it heartbreaking. Bonaparte had been killed by a living mob. A government had been formed from his old marshals, politicians, and spymasters, but they squabbled amongst themselves as the dead overran Paris. They probably squabbled even as they burned. Paris had been razed to the ground, as had all the major cities in Europe. A city so overrun could not be saved. Jack, Stephen, and the Blessings had laid the torches to Portsmouth, Dublin, and Calais themselves. The exiled king had been in Britain, and had died in the second wave. Stephen had just returned from talks with the new king and his sparse government in the new capital of Antibes. Jack took his hands and lifted him safely on board, breathing a sigh of relief. He did not know what would happen if the French had been inclined to be argumentative. "He has pledged all his resources to supporting our fight," Stephen said as he found his feet. "Our problem is that de Fleury is an enthusiast. He plans to be the hammer to Wellington's anvil. Wellington, of course, has other ideas." "Come below, my dear," said Jack, with absolutely no affection in his voice. "You must be exhausted, but I'm afraid I must know." "Of course, Jack, of course." Stephen gripped the companionway's rope and called for coffee for God's love. "Has Ivers finished?" he said, referring to the twice-weekly bite check he had instituted that took place on every British ship, whether or not any contact with solid ground had been made. "Not yet. He has a small part of the larboard watch yet to check. Pray ask him to include my marines." Stephen entered the grand cabin, collapsing into a chair. "Jesus, Mary, and Joseph! Even when they all agree in general, it is a labor of Hercules to persuade them to agree on a single specific item." "He will have to check you as well," Jack said, staring down at him blankly. Stephen went cold, as he had for months whenever Jack turned that look on him, and he nodded. "Well, go on." Stephen no longer flinched at that tone. "After they have fed their own citizens, they will supply us with a surplus. We have agreed that Antibes, Ouistreham, and Douarnenez will be maintained as food points, each with a strong garrison to repel the revenants. We were undecided as to Collioure. It is very close to the Pyrenees, and they might be overwhelmed." "That leaves us nowhere on the west coast." "I asked for Soulac-sur-Mer, but it was deemed too dangerous. Aquitaine is the most overrun region. They deemed it too great a risk." "Damn them," Jack growled as he marked the towns on a map. "They were reluctant to include Douarnenez. The town is only recently cleared. We need something on the west coast." "They have done a better job of clearing their country than we have of ours." Stephen did not falter under the hate-filled look that Jack sent him. "Have you given any more thought to my suggestion?" "I have," said Jack. "We will take Britain first."
"Jack, it has to be Ireland."
"It does not, Stephen. England is far more important." "In the old world, England was more important," Stephen said, more calmly than he felt. "In the old world, Britain had a population of 18 million in comparison to Ireland's 6. In the old world, that meant greater strength, but in this world, it means many more revenants." Jack's face flushed, and his lips tightened. He seemed about to retort, so Stephen quickly spoke again. "Ireland has arable land, coastland, and will have far fewer revenants. Far fewer. I predict by now they will have turned any that we did not evacuate long ago," he said, a slight tremor in his voice. He thought about the fierce colonists on the Skellig and Aran Islands, the Maharis, Inishbofin, Inishbegal, and Inishmurray, and continued. "We know that they need sustenance to survive. They will have started to starve weeks ago. We think the Highlands. If the Highland villages have survived this long, they will survive the time it takes for us to reclaim Ireland. And Ireland has the better land for growing food. We will be able to sustain ourselves without relying on Portugal and Prussia." Jack looked at him, his blue eyes like ice. "Very well. We will try for Ireland." Stephen did not smile. He had not smiled since Diana died,
but his face softened. "Thank you, brother. It is the right thing to do. Think of how we..."
"Never interrupt me again, doctor," Jack said, and walked out of the cabin, calling for Ivers.
From Dr. S. E. Maturin, Doctor of Medicine, Physician of the Fleet, of BIS Blessing. To be distributed to every British and Irish ship, colony and regiment of their armies, and there kept in copy to be read upon every Sunday, to be memorized by every man and woman so capable, and for all orders contained within to be obeyed, absolutely, on pain of death. Every person bitten will become a revenant. No exceptions to this rule have yet been discovered. Any person bitten is to be immediately killed. Approximately one-third of persons bitten will, before they die, exhibit a compulsion to bite others, usually accompanied by a rabid habit and furious countenance. Upon discovery of such a compulsion, this person is to be immediately shot or decapitated. Children and infants are to be particularly closely monitored, for the habit of biting is in their nature, and thus any infant is only to be killed when a surgeon has confirmed that the infant has been bitten itself. Any child or infant killed for biting without such proof will be counted the victim of murder. Every case will be examined individually. Every child and infant is to be checked twice a day for bites. Every person upon their death is to be decapitated. Their head and body are to be kept separate. If on land, their body is to be burned. If on the ocean, to be buried as in accordance with the customs of the sea. Any new or contradictory information is to be brought immediately to the attention of the discoverer's local surgeon, who will in turn ensure that this information is brought to the attention of Physician of the Fleet, S. Maturin, and Surgeon General, J. McGregor.
Stephen followed Jack in silence up onto the deck, where they found a loud argument taking place. Ivers, Stephen's assistant, was talking to one of Stephen's marine bodyguards. Robbins, who was standing on the deck, naked, not an uncommon sight these days, was in turn shouting at his friend and another of Stephen's protectors, a younger man called Cahill, who they had found shaking in the wreckage of Plymouth.
"You informing bastard! You bastard! Mr. Ivers, it was 1 hour and 5 days of talking and standing, for fuck's sake! Jem, you snitching dog! You were my mate!"
"What is this language?" Jack shouted, and silence fell on the deck. "What is this about, Ivers?" he said in a quiet voice, far more dangerous. Apparently, Ivers looked down at his feet, then darted a nervous glance at Robbins. Private Robbins spent some of his time on land in visiting a prostitute. The silence grew louder.
"You neglected your duty to protect the Physician of the Fleet to visit a whore," Admiral Aubrey said, advancing like the personified wrath of God.
"Sir, it was 1 hour, sir, when he was with the Frenchies. There was always the other three. He was never..."
"Have you any bites?" said Stephen, scrutinizing the man's face and the twitch in his jaw.
"No," Ivers answered for him.
"No bites at all, sir."
"Did you kiss her?" he asked Robbins softly.
Jack looked down at Stephen, an ugly look twisting his face.
"Did the prostitute kiss you?"
Robbins opened his mouth and shut it again, blinking in confusion.
"Answer the question, damn you!" Captain Aubrey roared.
Ivers managed at the last moment to stop himself from stepping backwards.
"Yes, sir, only a little, just at the beginning."
Robbins looked at Stephen imploringly.
"Sir, I haven't since before the plague."
"When you kissed, did she bite your lips or your tongue?" Stephen asked numbly.
The man's dawning comprehension and look of horror was enough to prompt Mowat to draw his pistol and shoot him in the head. Meat was usually saved for Sunday. Every other day was fish, for all but the fastest warships dragged nets behind them now. Jack had decided that he was best placed on the Blessing, which sailed steady and fast, instead of the bigger, slower ships. They took a weekly catch from the Heart of Oak, who stayed safely out at sea during their land missions.
"Cod again," said Joe Symes in cheerful complaint,
using his spoon to mash the hardtack up in the fish gravy. He looked at his neighbor's plate. "Hey, the doctor says you're to eat your seaweed."
"Bugger the doctor and bugger his seaweed," said Scott, and was rewarded with a thump on the shoulder from his other neighbor, Joe Place.
"He's gone quiet again," said Nathanson in concern. "And when the doctor's quiet, the Admiral's always fair tense. He's never been gabby. He's not some half-wit like Symes here."
Symes tossed a piece of seaweed at Place, who put it on his own plate with a smug look.
"It's the kid, Revies. He hates it when we get them in. Soon as he's done cutting them up, he'll be fine again."
"He doesn't shout any more. He used to always be shouting on the surprise," Nathanson pressed.
"Well, this ain't the bloody surprise, you stupid lubber."
"Watch out, Pullings," said Scott, and the mess table returned to concentrating on their food as the first lieutenant walked past.
"Eat your seaweed, Jack," Stephen said gently, not looking up from his own plate. "It is likely to be the last green thing you see before Duan Inez."
"I hate the bloody seaweed," Jack growled. "You've copied down what we got from the summers.
West Indies given up for lost, Mexico and Florida overrun, and containment thus far successful in the north." Stephen put his note down and picked up his fork again.
"There are further numbers which you know yourself. Will you have it distributed amongst the fleet? There remain some pockets in Canada, but it's not an insignificant victory."
"Yes," said Jack, sparing a piece of seaweed on his fork and glaring at it.
"I found nothing new in the Revenant children."
Jack ignored this, and Stephen pressed a piece of hardtack with the back of his fork so that the juices would soak into it enough to make it chewable.
"Shall I tell you some good news?" he said when he swallowed the biscuit.
"Do," said Jack, looking up. "God knows we could use some after that Bilbao disaster."
"You remember the colony on Inishbofin?"
"Of course I remember. The one run by that woman?"
"The same. Grace O'Leary," said Stephen in a slightly admonishing tone. He looked upon Inishbofin as their greatest success so far. But he was not yet ready to make his suggestions to Jack yet. Or, more accurately, he did not think Jack was yet ready to hear his suggestions.
"I received her report today. There was a birth."
Jack put down his knife and fork at that.
"Really? A birth?"
"A healthy girl," said Stephen softly. "It was the first live baby to be born who had been conceived after the plague."
"My word," said Jack, with a ghost of his old look about him. Stephen's heart leapt in his chest.
Jack looked away, disturbed by the intense hope in his eyes.
"I think that deserves a bottle. Killick! Killick, damn you, a bottle of wine! We must drink to a birth."
The Blessing found its harbour in Galway Bay, near Clarenbridge. The city of Galway was nothing but ruin and ash. With ships at Sligo, Bantry, Dingle, Kilkee, and Kinsale, they were confident that the west of Ireland was clear to 10 miles at every point from the shore. Stephen decided to wait. Connemara had been full of emaciated revenants in scattered pockets. They were quickly dealt with. Reports of larger bands came from the south. Hunger gave them desperation, but made them slow, and they were no match for the British sailors, battle-hardened and scarred by the worst year humanity had known. There was really no point in bringing anything up yet, Stephen thought. After a month, small groups of colonists from the islands around were ferried to the mainland. When Jack gave the order for one of the few English colonies on Guernsey to be moved to the south of Ireland, complete with a leader that he had picked out and appointed, Stephen knew the time had come to talk. "Jack, I have been contemplating the situation our colonists will face," he said, his voice casual as he entered the grand cabin. "Of course, I doubt there will be any trouble at all. We have all learnt that issues of nationality are minor in comparison to the breach between the living and the dead, but nonetheless I should hate for there to be any misunderstanding at all between the Irish colonists and the English." Jack looked up and blinked.
"Forgive me, Stephen, when you referred to our colonists, I thought you meant the English. Do continue."
"I meant the English as well, to be sure.
They are all our soul. Did we not rescue the majority of them ourselves?" Stephen said, sitting down.
"But I wish to be absolutely clear with you. Ireland is a free state now.
She no longer belongs to the English at all." Jack put down the quill he was writing with. "When were you going to tell me this idea of yours?" "It is not an idea. England is no more, so Ireland certainly cannot be a dominion of it. I suggest that once the colonists have fortified themselves and have a sufficient food production, that they should have the options for government presented to them without bias, and for them to choose for themselves how best they wish to govern themselves. The English colonists as well, of course. There is to be no discrimination in either direction." Jack stood up, his tone almost jovial, but his eyes cold. "It is out of the question, Stephen. This is not the time for fiddling about with democracies and parliaments while the revenants creep up on whatever unfortunate souls are brave enough to risk the attempted life." "It is not fiddling around. Now is the time for an absolute authority. That means martial law. Wellington agrees with me."
"Wellesley would," Stephen said darkly.
"But Jack, listen to me now. We cannot willingly hand over rule to a tyrant, because we are too cowardly and cynical to believe that people will not band together in a time of fear and hardship, and choose a more correct form of rule."
"Band together? Stephen, do you not remember London? Fighting over cabs? Or Dublin, for God's sake? Men throwing children to the revenants to slow them down?
Looting. Looting in Portsmouth.
That was the initial panic. These people have struggled together for a year now, with a minimal help from us after the initial rescue. We now have a chance to bring more people together in safety. We owe them that much. We would have starved without their support. They went hungry to feed. Stephen, I will place men I trust in charge of the mainland colonies, under martial law. That will make them safe. That is the end of the matter."
Stephen stood up.
"We will not create a tyrant. They have fought and lived for a year, choosing their own government. Guernsey has a democracy Athens would be proud of. And we will not take that away from them. I will not allow it."
"Doctor, you have absolutely no say.
The institution of a tyrant, because you are too cowardly."
Jack slammed his fist down on the table. "I warned you not to interrupt me."
"But you interrupt me with impunity. You are not a politico, Jack, and you never have been. A captain may be king on his own ship, but you are a sailor, not a statesman. I will not stand by while you place Ireland, any land, in the hands of tyrants. I will not let history say of us that we had the chance to create a better world, and instead we ape the atrocities of the past."
Jack had gone red in the face, but he looked oddly calm.
"Create a better world? With every country run by its own people, fairly, and if democracy is wished for, then it shall be democracy, with equality above all, and no discrimination on the idea of religion or race or... The Americans are still clinging to slavery, for God's love. If you would expect, revenants or no, that the people who have clawed a survival out of rocks would tolerate martial tyrants lording over them, chosen by the King of the Pirates and the Lord High Ascendant, when they have been independent and self-governing, with a blank slate and the ability, and what is more, the compulsion, to make this world a fairer, better place than before the plague."
Jack grabbed Stephen by the front of his coat and slammed him against the bulkhead.
"Create a better world?"
Stephen stared in shock, standing on his toes lest he be strangled. His eyes widened in horror.
"No, Jack, you misunderstand. I did not mean...
The world can be a better place now that my wife and children are dead?" The blood was fast draining from Jack's face, turning him a ghastly pale color. Stephen struggled and then held his hands up, desperate to calm him.
"Jack, you know I would never think that. You know what Sophie meant to me, and Diana, and your children.
Jack, let us sit down. Whatever you wish to talk about."
"I wish to talk about you, you cold, enthusiastic bastard."
Jack could not understand this man, who had once been his friend. How could he place his intellectual ideals over the lives of people they had saved, the desperate societies that they had sacrificed so much for, had fought for tooth and claw? He would let the revenants take them,
for want of solid martial protection, for abstract concepts, because of his personal petty dislike for tradition. You unfeeling dog! The anger he had felt for a year finally broke through the barriers of reserve and authority. He shook the smaller man, feeling a vicious satisfaction when the back of his head bounced off the bulkhead. What Sophie meant to you? You did not even cry! That was when he had first felt the fury, he remembered, when he saw Stephen looking at Ashgrove Cottage, a kind of childlike curiosity on his dry face. You cried when that whore died, but not my wife or my children! Stephen's eyes were wide and so pale. The hurt and betrayal in them were enough to send Jack into a rage. How dare he feel wronged? After all he had done for him. Jack's grip tightened. She loved you. She made me go to you, because she knew that you would fall apart. You weak, selfish. I would have been there. I could have protected them. Jack. Jack, Stephen said, his voice ragged, his crippled hands pulling at his own. Jack stared at him in disgust, letting go and wiping his hand on his jacket. You could not have. You would not have known what it was. You would have been killed, just like... Just like Sophie? Just like my son and my daughter? Stephen went very still. He had been reaching up to his throat, but his hand stopped, poised in mid-air. Your daughters, Jack. My daughter, he spat. You were there, doctor. You examined the bodies. My mother-in-law, my wife, my son, my daughter, lying there. Had he not been standing pressed against the bulkhead, Jack suspected Stephen would have taken a step back. Such was the fear on his face, an unusual expression. Jack felt cold, chilled throughout, and numb. My other daughter was not dead until you put a bullet in her head. Jack, listen to me, Stephen said gently, holding his hands out as if to calm him. The gesture was not needed. Jack, after his fury, felt deadly calm. That was not Charlotte. It was a revenant. Both of your daughters were dead before we ever came to Ashgrove. Just like Diana was dead when you decapitated her body. They were bodies, dangerous, wild, killing bodies. It was already dead, and it had killed before, and it would have killed us as well. You saw a figure coming out of the shadows, and you knew that it was a revenant. Her hair had been loose, as though it had been combed, ready to be plaited. Yes, I saw them in London, just as you had. We both saw Diana. It was not a revenant. You assumed it was a revenant, out of fear, you coward. She might have hidden during the massacre, had stepped out of her hiding place, stunned, to go to her father, her rescuer. Jack, for God's love, we saw it. We have seen thousands since it. It was a revenant, we know it was. Stephen looked genuinely afraid, his face twisted in grief. It was the most emotion he had shown since he shot Charlotte. You said shoot her. Jack felt a murderous, quiet rage sweep through him when he saw Stephen's face fall. Jack, you did not say shoot it. You said shoot her. Jack, I was in shock. I did not. And when I would not, you did it yourself. Jack, why would I want to kill your child? Stephen shouted, his voice finally breaking. Revenge, perhaps, because I killed Diana? He asked the question casually, and it gave him great pleasure to see the pain it caused. Stephen shook his head, his voice imploring. No, 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 Jack, you did not kill Diana. It was a revenant. It was... Jack opened the door, taking Stephen's wrist and crushing it. He leant close to the man who had once been like a brother to him, his best friend, the companion he had admired and saved and loved, and whispered, "You are the reason my family is dead. You murdered my daughter. Get out of my sight." He threw him out, watched him trip and sprawl in front of the staring marines, watched the white face turn up to look at him, broken. He shut the door and felt alive for the first time since he had stepped into the gloom and gore of Ashgrove Cottage. The numbness vanished, the anger vanished, the blame vanished, and only loss and unbearable pain replaced it.
That night, Jack dreamed of Charlotte. When he woke up, his face was wet, and he felt exhausted by guilt, a heavy, leaden feeling that increased tenfold when he thought of Stephen. He told himself that he associated the feeling with Stephen because Stephen had been able to tell them apart, and he had not. Clever, clever Stephen. There was no challenge. Such a thing could never be condoned these days, especially not concerning two leading figures of the new floating state. But there was no apology either. Had Stephen come to the grand cabin, Jack thought, begging for reconciliation and tearfully apologizing. But Stephen just grew thinner, and his face grew paler, and the violet bruises under his eyes grew darker, until he did not so much look like a revenant as an animated skeleton. Every time he looked at Jack, the despair on his face, its intensity so incongruous with Stephen's secretive nature, made his gut clench in guilt. He looked more vulnerable by far, than he had when Jack had carried him out of the governor's house in Mahon, and for an instant he wanted nothing more than to comfort his friend, to let him weep all his pain onto his shoulder, to talk to him. But it was so intense that it could be nothing but deliberate, and Jack felt the old feeling and the old anger that he was being manipulated by Stephen. For clever, deep Stephen knew these things. He convinced himself that it was a look calculated and perfected, and he swept by imperiously, with a glare of loathing. Out of his peripheral vision, he saw Stephen's head bow, his shoulders curl in. The doctor spoke even less now, for the most part communicating almost eloquently by means of monosyllabic questions, nods, exhalations, and grunts of mild disgust. Many of the lower deck, having lived in fear of that pale reptilian glare, now longed for its return. Had the doctor's pupils been white instead of black, his eyes could have passed for a revenant. The admiral, on the other hand, had grown more than tyrannical enough to compensate. Floggings for slight misdemeanors, and two deaths for unauthorized land visits. Some of the old Sophies remembered the last time this had happened, as did one or two Polycrests. But the admiral had been softer then, and the doctor had been defiant. The call that there was a sail on the horizon was common enough, the lack of red topgallants symbolizing a ship that was entirely free of revenants was not. The ship was huge, but a mess, sheets and sails hanging in torn disarray, and she sat silently bobbing on the water. The HMS Victory had been overrun by revenants a matter of weeks after London burnt. They knew this because they had managed to rescue a cutter full of survivors who spoke of a single victim, begging to come aboard and concealing a bite in the crook of his elbow. Within days, the ship was lost. The Victory had been lost, presumably under the waves or smashed on the rocks of Brittany. And yet, within an hour, Jack and his lieutenants, as well as the marine captain Roberts, Captain Crilly had been killed in Portsmouth, and Stephen, were discussing whether or not to board her. She was a first-rate ship, with valuable weapons and perhaps even supplies, the revenants lacking all sentience. Lacking all sentience, but needing sustenance. Roberts pointed out that the revenants would have no way of sailing, and would lack knowledge and compulsion to leave the ship, and that in the months since everyone had been turned, most of them would have been eaten by their fellows, and the rest weak or dead of starvation. A ship was always needed, and such a ship. The risks were minimal. It was doubtful that any revenants survived, and those few would be quickly dealt with. Pullings and Mowat enthusiastically agreed. Stephen nodded in silent confirmation of the assessment. The Victory would be an immense victory, Jack said, with no hint of a smile. Stephen looked down at his lap. We will board.
Jack knew why he was insisting on leading the group of sailors and marines to the Victory himself. For all that had happened, to him, to England, to the world, even if the ship had seen terrible massacres, both sudden and slow, and would be full of the half-eaten corpses of revenants, the Victory was still Nelson's flagship. Bonden looked nervously at Stephen as the cutter kissed the side of the Victory. The doctor had approached the admiral, clutching a notebook and a medicine case, presenting his reasons for joining the exploratory team in a monotone. He wished to examine the scene for himself, to check for anomalies among the corpses, to see what remained of the ship's medical stores. The admiral had cut him off with a dismissive gesture and nodded his assent. The doctor looked hurt and thanked him formally. "It don't bode well," Joe Place had muttered to his cousin. Since he had met them both, Bonden had never seen Captain Aubrey willingly allow Dr. Maturin to walk into danger. A seaman's life had always been isolated from the world on land, and the laws of the sea had always been strict. It was only now that Bonden understood how much had happened, and how much would never be the same. The ship, as predicted, was silent. Signals were made for more boats to come over to bring the best supplies back to the Blessing. Pullings would captain the Victory, Jack thought, or perhaps he himself. It was Nelson's flagship, after all, and with some work it could once again be the pride of the Navy. There was a body in the scuppers, mostly decayed. Stephen was peering at it with only curiosity on his face. Jack turned away.
"Sir, permission to go down into the hold, sir. I should like to see how much ammunition we can salvage."
Jack nodded in response to Captain Roberts and crossed over to the side of the ship, looking down and then up. The ropes would have to be entirely replaced, he thought. They were so terribly frayed. Tar had melted and splattered over the deck during the summer. The sails were weather-worn, but otherwise in good condition. Revenants could manage stairs and companionways, but never rigging. There was a scream. Everyone immediately looked to the aft companionway, where two revenants had fallen upon the struggling, shrieking Captain Roberts. One looked up from biting out the marine officer's throat and was shot in the forehead. A marine private ran forward to decapitate the other, but stepped back as the revenants poured up onto the deck, stampeding over the now twitching body. 10, 20, 30, 40. They had a handful of officers, mostly warrant, the crew of the cutter, and a small band of marines, taken as a nod to proper procedure. The deck was alive with pistol and musket fire. One marine pulled Stephen back. Another stabbed his bayonet into the forehead of a revenant making for the carpenter. Most of them were wearing tattered French uniforms. "The stupid bastards," Jack thought viciously as he shot one of the revenants, then tossed away his used pistol, drawing his sword to decapitate another. They must have seen the floating ship and thought it an easy prize, giving fresh fuel to the weakened few revenants left. These were well-fed and strong. He swung around to kill another, but it gripped the end of his sword, not caring about the blood pouring down its arm. The revenant stared blankly at Jack, tasting the air with a writhing grey tongue, and calmly snapped the sword in two. Jack's eyes widened. This must have been one of the Victories. A year-old revenant, with a year's strength and speed. The side of its head was blown out, and it fell to the deck with a gurgle, one white-pupilled eye staring accusingly up at Jack. He was distracted by another revenant, in sailor's rags, running at him, its speed greater than that of any human, its face contorted in bloodlust. Jack held out his broken sword, as much use as a penknife. A year. Most did not last a year. A frail monochromatic figure pushed him aside with surprising strength. Jack fell, cracking his head against the steps of the quarterdeck. He looked up, stunned. The heel of Stephen's palm was beneath the revenant's chin, violently pushing its jaw up and his head backwards so that it could not bite him. It furiously clawed at his face instead, for both of Stephen's hands were trying to keep its head back. Jack watched in horror. Behind the jagged scratches and pouring blood, Stephen's face was serene with relief. The struggle lasted less than a second. They had been fighting in an instant of perfect and precarious balance. But Stephen's momentum had pushed them both over the edge of the ship, smashing through the old rail. There was a sickening crack, a cry, and then the splash as the two bodies hit the surface of the water. The fight was dying away. The crew was quite experienced in these matters. Jack stared down in horror, the grief he had only ever felt in Ashgrove flooding him. The revenant bobbed to the surface, staring up blindly from white pupilled eyes. It was dead, because even the oldest revenant did not have the sentience to pretend to be so, especially in so chaotic an element as water. Stephen did not emerge. He always sank, like the most innocent of witches. Jack pulled off his jacket frantically as the last revenant was stabbed several times in the head and face from two of the marines, and was pulling off his boots when Mowat ran up to him. "Sir, sir, you cannot, you must not. Lieutenant, you did not give orders to me." "Sir, if he survived, he'd have been bit. You cannot." Jack tossed away his boots. "Have ropes ready," he said, and dived into the water. He blessed his years of experience in diving, but even with them it hurt a great deal. The quarter-deck of the Victory was a very high point from which to dive, and it felt like slamming into wood. But the water parted between his tightly pointed fingers and swallowed him, dark and freezing. He resurfaced, whole body aching, and took the knife from his waist, plunging it into the top of the revenant's head, at the weakest part of the skull. There was no change of expression at all, but its head lolled hideously. Stephen had broken its neck. Jack dived again, looking for Stephen, who had attacked a revenant with his bare hands. They had not known breaking a revenant's neck would kill it. If Stephen survived, he would be fascinated, because no one had ever attacked a revenant with their bare hands. That man in London had, Jack corrected himself, and then all other thought went from his mind, because he had found Stephen. The ropes were waiting, as he had ordered, when he broke through the surface again, gasping for air, Stephen in his arms. He tied a bowline around the doctor, then climbed another, reaching the deck just as they pulled Stephen over the side. His leg was twisted horribly, broken by the portholes or the outward curve of the ship, or, most likely, hitting the water from such a height. And he was not breathing. Jack desperately searched his mind for other drowning survivors as someone put a jacket around him. What had Stephen done to Ellis? Upside down and cigar smoke. Upside down. Hold him upside down. The carpenter, looking at his captain in fear, meekly offered, "We must check him for bites first." "It was dead. Hold him upside down," said Jack, in a voice that was feared more than his roar. The tallest of the marines reached down and grabbed both of the doctor's ankles, wrenching them up. Before Jack could shout for him to stop, Stephen woke up screaming, vomited a copious amount of brine onto the deck, and then passed out. As he watched Stephen's chest rise and fall, Jack realized that he could breathe again as well. The argument echoed in his mind. Stephen's broken face, the weeks of silence and hatred and anger, and all of it so unjustified. He knew as well as Stephen had that Charlotte was a revenant, but he had needed someone, anyone, to blame, and in doing so he had ruined the only good thing he had in this terrible world. Charlotte. "Christ," he said, his voice low and ragged. "Bites. He must be checked. Strip him." Stephen opened his eyes and stared at the beam above him. He was in Jack's cabin, he knew, for the light of a setting sun was streaming through the window behind his head. The light was mottled from the glass and played across the ceiling in tones of flame and amber, scarlet and gold, and the myriad of notes of tawny autumn, like the sparkling strains of cello music, deep and throbbing.
It glinted off the needle of the compass set into the warm wood of the beam. The needle wavered, and Stephen wavered with it. Then he remembered the world. It was too much to bear. He fell back into sleep.
When next he woke, it was raining. The room was grey and blue from sea and sky. Jack was sitting at the table with his charts, looking haggard. Stephen saw that his hair was grey, too, and not just from the light. His heart clenched in his chest to see his friend so sad, so old and bent. "My dear," he croaked, then frowned at the pain in his throat. "Stephen, you're awake!" Jack threw down his pen and immediately went to his side, looking down into his face with an expression that Stephen took a moment to recognize as joy. For a single beautiful instant he looked like the old Jack, the Jack before the plague, the Jack of happiness and music and laughter and wretched, wretched puns, and Stephen smiled to see him. But the joy vanished as soon as it had appeared, and Jack looked away, not daring to meet the hope in Stephen's eyes. "Stephen, doctor, Stephen, so very sorry. The things I said, I regret nothing more," he said, his voice growing more ragged and strained at every interjection. Stephen reached out of the hammock and took his hand. "Enough, brother." Jack met his eyes again, looking down at him imploringly. He stared at Stephen's hand weakly gripping his own and sat down in a chair next to the hammock. Jack took a deep breath and began again. "Doctor," he began, with the air of someone reciting something much rehearsed, "I much regret." Stephen shook his head. "I said enough, Jack, for God's love. There's no need to prattle on. You were always much too loquacious, upon my word." He wiped his own eyes, though, and squeezed Jack's hand. Jack ignored the tears on his own cheeks and smiled lovingly, feeling for the first time in over a year that he was Jack Aubrey again. "Now help me up. The fleet has probably been overrun without me to see to things, and my leg itches damnably." Jack's smile vanished. "You just rest, Stephen. Let me get some portable soup for you. You will want a cup of water. Would you like something cool for your head?" "I want to sit up, damn you." Stephen struggled. The swinging of the hammock made him feel nauseous. Jack pushed him down gently. "Not too fast, my dear." "My leg is hellish itchy. Leave off, Jack." Stephen twitched the blanket aside and stared down. He went pale, but not as pale as Jack. "Oh." "You broke it when you fell," said Jack, sorrowful and apologetic. "It became infected." Stephen swallowed. "Indeed." He raised the stump, looking at it curiously. "And yet it still itches. I have heard patients complaining of it, but I had not thought that it would be so real. Just below the patella, the operation must have been..." "Who stitched this?" Jack frowned in confusion. "Ivers, of course." "That mumping idiot is to practice his lambent stitch, do you hear? It is shameful, quite shameful," Stephen said, still staring. "Is it..." Jack looked worried. "Will it do?" "I suppose so," said Stephen, with an air of weary resignation. "I would not risk opening it again in any case. I must have slept for a long time."
"You did," said Jack, remembering of the seemingly endless days of fever.
Stephen had sobbed for hours and hours and hours, until he exhausted himself and fell asleep, hiccuping, only to dream of Diana tossing away the splintered wood of her coffin, or Ashgrove Cottage, or the hundreds of people they had not been able to save. Jack knew what he was dreaming about, for Stephen spoke of it all, raggedly, constantly, and woke up again, weeping, apologizing to the faces around his hammock, only one of them real. Jack had remembered his thoughts after that terrible fight, when he had thought he wanted Stephen to apologize. Now the apologies came again and again, and each one broke his heart. He had apologized to Diana, to Sophie, to Jack's children in turn, in Irish, over and over, sobbing,
to a laundry, to the mauled bodies of children in the city streets. He pointed them out to Jack, and Jack had seen them in his mind's eye, and to Jack most of all.
"Jack, do not look like that," said Stephen, not unkindly, breaking his reverie. "I will do very well. I have twice as many stockings now, at least. I assume you have had a wooden leg made."
"Not yet," said Jack, startled by the content look on Stephen's face.
"I will order one made immediately. It will be very comfortable. Mr. McNish is uncommon clever with things like this. You'll be galloping around like..." He flushed. "I'm sure you'll be up and about in no time."
Stephen nodded thoughtfully.
"And I want a second one, with a fork at the bottom, so that I can climb the rigging."
Jack stared at him.
"Stephen, you cannot be serious."
He anxiously reached out a hand to feel Stephen's forehead.
"I'm not delirious. Noli me tangere, you mountebank, as though you could test for a fever, for God's love. No, I will climb the rigging. Taken beneath the joint as it is, I will have just as much grace as before."
Jack bit his tongue.
"And I'm hungry. Have we anything in the stores beside that damned seaweed?"
"The commencement loaded us with stores 4 days ago, and we have a wheel of cheese and some bread that is not yet stale."
Stephen smiled. "Then I think I will have some toasted cheese."
Life went on. Populations began to stabilize, if not yet rise. Slowly, production of food increased, though seaweed was becoming more and more difficult to find. Days went by without seeing a revenant. Weeks went by without a new case. "Revy fucker" became the superlative insult of the lower deck. Jack remained autocratic, for now that the threat from revenants grew less, the threat of anarchy and selfishness dramatically increased, but he was seen to smile from time to time. Stephen was collating his information on revenants and the plague that caused them into a comprehensive study on the matter, as an aid to understanding in both the present and the future. Once, the doctor called the admiral a tyrant, sparking an argument later narrated in full in The Marine's Birth. They both sulked all night and all day, but the doctor was invited to the grand cabin for a game of cards that evening, and the ship as one man sighed in relief. Stephen completely ignored every one of Jack's reasons why he was not allowed to climb the rigging, and bullied Mr. McNish mercilessly until he was given his forked leg. He immediately took to designing new ones to fit more comfortably, increase balance or speed, to bend where the ankle should be, to make chasing animals up cliffs easier, and then felt guilty that he had never turned his mind to the issue until he was directly affected. With practice on the deck, the leg grew more easy and comfortable to use, though at night it itched unbearably if Stephen did not drink his dose. He climbed the rigging once, Jack climbing behind him, with an expression of pure panic on his face, but it took such a long time that even Stephen was forced to agree to a bosun's chair in the future. When one was drunk, the rapid thud-thud-step, thud-thud-step overhead took on a positively nightmarish quality. He found he could delight in birds again. Jack put his family to rest in his heart. He knew that no matter what logical arguments could be made, he would never have another. At least there was Stephen. He was the only thing that made Jack think of himself as a person anymore, and not the revenant of Jack Aubrey carrying out his duty. After their horrific fight, anguish had awoken them from their numbness, and pain had made them tender. The bond between them was strengthened almost out of necessity, and their affection for each other, rarely acknowledged aloud but always present, became even deeper than it had been before the plague. Having sorted such thoughts through in his head, Stephen had probably scrawled the same thoughts down in his diary weeks ago. Jack wondered if in their colonies there might be a maker of instruments, and if they could find the materials, whether he would make a violin and a cello for them. Perhaps they might find instruments, but he felt that new ones were called for. It was this he pondered on a Sunday afternoon, arguing with himself as to whether or not he might gently offer the idea to Stephen, who was being as brave as any creature on the earth, but had always had a vulnerable heart, and such a suggestion might make him melancholy with memory. He was late in returning from Mass on shore. Jack was not worried, not yet, though his stomach grumbled. Stephen Maturin did not need to be attacked by the living dead to be late for something. Presently he heard the distinctive sounds that accompanied Stephen onto the ship. The fussing of sailors and marines alike. Kindnesses returned in the familiar coin of irritation, and a low, harsh muttering of curses. Stephen entered the cabin without knocking, sitting at the table and letting his crutch fall carelessly onto the floor. Killick had tripped over it, drunk and sober, more times than they could count. "There you are, Stephen." Jack smiled sweetly, and was gratified to see a slight smile in answer as the doctor tugged at his neckcloth. "Forgive my lateness, my dear. I know you have been busy this morning with all your usual Sunday traditions. As we were about to leave, one child asked whether Christ was a revenant, which caused the priest to fumble and stutter and give an hour's impromptu lecture on the resurrection, the boy's father cuffing him about the head throughout, which is why I come to you late and famished. Where is that half-witted mumping baboon with some coffee for all love?" "I've already had a pot, but I called for some more earlier," said Jack, as Killick carried a fresh batch. Stephen greedily snatched up a cup and held it out. "Here, here. Which it is cold with waiting so long, all set out. No steam, as you like," mumbled Killick. But Stephen was instantly mollified, and settled into his chair with a look of contentment as he sipped. The look was enough to prompt Jack into asking, "Stephen, were I able to find a luthier somewhere, would you perhaps like a cello made? I think new ones instead of some poor. I mean, would you care to play with me again? It has been a long time, but..." Stephen smiled warmly. "With all my heart." There was a groan from the steward's cabin. The end. I'm Lutzula, and thank you for listening. This has been a reading of The Zombriad by The Elbe. You can find more of the other stories at teh-elb.livejournal.com.